Right. Okay, so... This is the title that Janine asked me. Janine has been pestering me for about 2 years for this, and the problem we realised we ran into is Janine was giving me lots of time because she assumed I was very busy. And that wasn't true at all. So she'd say, how about talking in 6 months' time? By the time 6 months had come along, I'd finally got round to organising, going to the shops or something, and it instantly clashed. So eventually she realised that the best thing to do would be, in true journalistic sense, to hit me with a very quick deadline. So she said, you're speaking next month, what are you speaking about? On the phone, I said this, off the top of my head. How European and American tech markets are growing apart, and what kind of headache that gives me in the morning. It was a morning, I did have a headache. It was a sort of inspiration for the whole thing. That is me, and there'll be these details will be on the end. Because we're running so late, I will speak very quickly. If you want me to speak much quicker, just say so. If you want me to speak slower, don't bother, because I won't hear you while I'll be speaking so quickly, and I speak this quickly anyway. Who am I? Right, this is a question that you often ask about people when you read about them in the newspapers. You sit there every column and go, who the heck is this guy? I found the easiest way of finding out about people, for instance, it's how I found out about SD Forum, is to go to a site called Googleism.com. Does anyone use Googleism? No? Okay, I'll explain Googleism. Googleism is a front end to Google. Everyone knows Google, good. And what it does is it goes through Google's search results and finds out what people have been saying about the string that you put in. So if you put in SD Forum, you actually get very nice things. You say people say it's a wonderful way of meeting people, la 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 da da, and it goes through a train of these things that it's found on the web. So I assumed the best way to find out about me was just to type Danny O'Brien into Googleism. There we go. So this is what I came up with. Right, this is Googleism for me. I'm not sure if you can see the whole text here. It's just a front. It's very plain. It's very in the spirit of Google. It's Googleism for Danny O'Brien. Danny O'Brien is a white English-speaking guy, which I think you probably picked up on. Danny O'Brien, senior executive with ICI of Oregon. Different Danny O'Brien, I think. Danny O'Brien is the lead singer and songwriter for The Minimum Requirements. I know, this may be a future feature of Google. Maybe in 2010. Danny O'Brien is out of work. Again, maybe a future thing. Danny O'Brien is... Yes, I can confirm that. So this is the one I like the best. Danny O'Brien is a British lazy, stupid journalist... And and so this is probably what I concentrate here. This is as good an epithet for me as any. It's actually from my homepage, where I casually refer to myself as this in a kind of deprecatory way. And somebody else copied it and put it on their site and said, I don't know much about Danny O'Brien, but I do know one thing. But it does give us a context for what I'm about to say. First thing is though I did mention Europe and my getting up at 9 o'clock in the morning and making up a title, I am British, not European. There's a famous, I don't know whether any of you know this, but there's a famous Times headline, possibly apocryphal, Times being the paper I work for from the 1920s, that says, fog in channel, continent isolated. This is largely a confession on my part, in that I did say Europe in my piece, but I suddenly realised as I went to write this that I don't know enough about Europe, and there are plenty of people here, I'm sure, who can tell you about the European situation. So, ultimately, I lied in the piece. This is mostly going to be about the interaction between the British market and the American market. But I think a few lessons do come through and do pan out and apply, not only to Europe, actually, but a lot of the Silicon Valley's view to all around the world. I came stupid, this is true. Wild opinions unsubstantiated with fact is not another Googleism quote, but this is probably the format that I will take here. I will just wildly assert things. There is one fact, no, two, in today's show, and I want to see if you can spot them. The rest of it is just my own impressions, having lived here and kept an eye on the British scene for the last 3 years. Journalists, well, see stupid. Wild opinions, unsubstantiated with fact, is my business. That's why I'm here. Okay, well, actually, that's not entirely true. One thing I didn't mention there was lazy, which I originally, when I wrote the slide, I can't be bothered to explain that. But actually, laziness plays in a lot here. I'm the tech columnist for the London Sunday Times. I write a very small weekly column every week. Hard work. I moved to Silicon Valley in 2000, partly to report on the amazing scene that was going on here, partly because of my wife. But mostly I did it because I'm lazy. And let me explain why. This involves going back. This is the longest introduction to a speaker you will ever see, but I like talking about myself. I used to work for a magazine called Wired UK. It was a spin-off of Wired magazine. This was back in 1995. It bombed terribly for lots of reasons, and if you get me drunk afterwards, I'll tell you them all. But the main one was this. Wired as a magazine aimed to speak about what people would be doing, and this was the internal thing that we discussed, about what people were doing 3 months into the future. It's like very, very short term if you're thinking in terms of investment capital, but actually quite long term if you're thinking about what people will be thinking and talking about. This is one of the hard things about journalism, is if you're working in a fashion magazine, people think, well, fashion magazines, obviously a very simple thing, you just go and hang out with, I don't know, supermodels all day, and then write about it. But in fact, you have to anticipate what the fashions are going to be in the future. This is somewhat compounded. This is something that may people may experience when dealing with journalists. That they have these incredibly long lead times, print journals, particularly in the days of now that we live in the web, where you're actually having to think 6 months ahead of time. So people are often people come up to me as a journalist and say, "I'd love you to write about this thing. It's happening next week. Could you get something in for Friday?" And I do have to say no, because Janine was showing me one of the columns that I'd written, and she was saying, "So, you know, this is a great column." And I was going, "I have no memory about what I wrote in that, because I wrote it about 3 months ago, and I've written so many columns since then." So there is this problem about being, in Wired's case, 6 months ahead of the pack. And this is in 1995, and this is at the very heat, where, you know, people were using different browsers 6 months ahead. One of the worst things that happened in Wired, in retrospect, but entirely understandable, is Wired was one of the last magazines, or the last sort of online publications, as it were, to realize that the web was going to take off. I can show you a very funny article where they're going, "Mosaic, hit or miss." I'm going, "It's not Mosaic. I'm using Netscape now. I'm using Netscape 2.3. I've been through 4 betas since you wrote this article." It's a genuine problem, and I think it's a big problem for companies who are doing forward-looking things, talking to journalists. It was particularly bad for writing a magazine called Wired UK. The UK in 1995 was just not at the same level as Wired was, as Silicon Valley was. We'd write this stuff that was 6 months ahead, as the Wired spec, and nobody understood what we were talking about in Britain, including us. We'd be sitting and writing about stuff like, for instance, actually quite complicated stuff about the intricacies of investment and venture capital and things like this, which are things that, for instance, in Cambridge, people knew very well, but we weren't writing for a Cambridge audience. And I think it's very surprising over the last 5 to 7 years how much of the kind of knowledge that was originally restricted to Silicon Valley and perhaps the investment centers in Boston, which is now general knowledge. You know, there was a time when people just didn't know what VCs were, and now people do have a sort of in-depth knowledge about this. This was certainly true back in 1995. In Britain, if we were to write about venture capitalism, investment opportunities, and so forth, people would say, "No, this is too dry even for The Economist. Put some jokes in." And then this strange thing would happen. Wired UK lasted for about 2 years, and about a year into it, people started reading our back issues and emailing us saying, "Oh, that's a very good point you're making there. It's very interesting. Yeah. Is there anywhere can I get the next month's issue from last year?" No, we're bust now. They've sacked me. So I hit upon more or less his law. I'd like to say this is what I called it, but of course I just invented this for this presentation. This was a very common. Don't laugh. The continent I live on. This was a very common perception for a very long time. Europe is more or less 18 months behind the US. And the UK is more or less 18 months behind the US. And let's see if I can click using this trackball. These don't count as facts. These are just me quoting other journalists. Here we go. This is the part of it. This is most industry analysis agree that the UK is well placed in comparison to other European countries in terms of e-commerce. They're as much as 18 months to 2 years behind the US. And if I click on this, move to the next one. This is from a London magazine that talks about growth in internet use, where somebody again says, we think the UK is about 18 months behind the US. And the US did it. So we have this idea as Silicon Valley. Oh, and also it spreads. Asia is also 18 months behind you. Here we are, Asian e-commerce, 18 months behind US. And so it goes on. It must be some jet lag thing. And this was actually a fairly good rule of thumb for a very long period when I was writing. And one of the reasons why I actually came over here, because as a lazy, stupid journalist, whatever, it's much easier to report in the news if you're 18 months ahead of the deadline. And indeed, this is how it happened. These are a few of the pieces that I've written in the last month. I wrote about movie ripping in 2000. I wrote about 802.11 Wi-Fi in July 2000. Instant messaging client, again, very odd. Writing about when instant messaging clients were often used in companies, actually, I think the article was about how companies were trying to stop people using instant messaging clients. And this was a problem that was hitting American companies just after a bunch of, small startups had tried to put instant messaging clients into the workplace and then realized, no, we've got to stop them. They're not answering their email, which is their other job. And this was something I wrote about in May 2001, and this was not a problem in the UK at that point. Broadband saturation, the idea that I'll go back to this one. DSL and things like this were beginning to slow down take up. And the Roomba, has anyone used the Roomba? I'm slipping a few really good gadgets into this talk, so I'll tell you. The Roomba is a robot vacuum cleaner. You've probably seen the rats. I had this great opportunity because I went and bought one, and in the same way as you bore your friends, about how great the latest gadget you've got is, I got to bore like 1.5 million people about how great it was. But before they had a chance, while it was still new. However, something's happened in the last, I guess, 6 to 9 months about this easy job of mine that I've had. And basically the point of this talk is just to go into some detail about what I see happening. Because I think it's something that applies to not only to companies who are looking to go into other markets other than the American market, but also if people are thinking of investing and also people are thinking of coming over here. It's very hard to put my finger on it, so I'm just going to scatter you with a few impressions. Okay, the first one is very easy. In Britain and Europe, it's always been this 18-month thing can be turned around somewhat. It can be said that mobile phone technology is 18 months ahead of America. And this again, is almost as commonplace an idea in Europe as the reverse is true in America about internet and PC takeup. The idea is that eventually you will realize how to text message. Eventually you'll touch on. And also eventually you'll go out and buy a phone. God damn you. We've got all these phones that we've built and we need another market for them. So I never really wrote about mobile phones. I wrote a couple of pieces about mobile phones. But then I realized that I was actually losing touch with what was happening in Britain regarding mobile phones. I'd come over there and people would be pulling it. Somebody pulled out this thing which he was using to answer his email, which is not, the most amazing thing to do on a mobile phone, but he was able to do it. He wasn't using WAP. He wasn't just going, I can answer my email on this, somehow. He was doing, no, I actually do read my email on this device, and stuff like MIDI ringtones. Things where people were having huge orchestras were going on in the train. Wasn't there little bleeps which I can identify and filter if they're not mine, but entire like drum solos followed by the theme tune to Star Wars. I assume they're going, somewhere in here there's a small orchestra. And then people would pick up their phone and start talking. So it's the soundtrack to their lives. Let's go back, because this is quite a hard one. Okay, so something's happening there, but I think there's something slightly more important going on. And these are, I won't give this away, but this may be a fact. If you look here, this is kind of where I started talking. And if you see here, there is actually an 18-month difference between these pickups. The red one here is the UK, which only started really picking up this. This lies, by the way. This is the online population. This is the percentage of people who are online. And you can see that 18 months is actually not a bad estimate between these differences. But things start changing around about here, around about 2000, late 2000. In both cases, this is actually odd. On the website, I'll actually put where I got these figures from. But I think it's Nielsen net ratings. One of the things that's interesting about the latest Nielsen net ratings is in the US and the UK, you've just got a tiny tick down, which means that basically the churn has just... things are beginning to saturate, and the churn is just eating off a little people. I don't think it's going to do this down here. I don't, eventually you'll only have 10 people online talking on Usenet. But it's definitely taking off a bit. And what that means is this difference starts pinching out. This distance starts getting smaller. So you can no longer really say that the UK is 18 months behind. And this is PC ownership. Now, PC ownership is actually much more interesting because, look around here, this is kind of the period of which I spoke earlier, so 1999-2000 here. And again, it's actually a bit shorter than PC ownership, but you still have the curves roughly mirroring each other, just slightly lower for the UK. Except if you look here, from 94, the figures for British PC usage actually go back quite a lot further from the American ones. These are both government figures. Government economic status things, where they go around and ask people what they bought recently was any good. And what you have here is the British actually had more PCs as a percentage of population than America did for a very long period, going back to 1984. And in fact, rather than just being a case of America, Britain chasing and then eventually catching up, this is actually a blip. The thing where America was temporarily ahead of Britain, and I think probably by extension a lot of Europe, a lot of the more affluent European states, was just a temporary boost. It was just, and I think theorizing wildly here, I think it was actually the internet that did this. I think the internet actually, because you see that this picked up slightly here, I think what happened is the internet came to America earlier, and this encouraged people to buy PCs. And the people saw the internet and wanted it, so they went out and bought PCs. And that gave them a little rider above it. One of the pieces I referred to earlier was an article saying we were 18 months behind America in PC ownership. And I think that was just a temporary state of affairs. This is just to give another example of me writing about stuff. The general perception in the UK, people in the UK are... I'm forever being commissioned to write things about how can we do DSL, how can we do broadband better, like it's done in America. And, of course, this is not the case. The service and availability, the pieces that I write say, I'd love to write about DSL and broadband in America, but I can't get hold of one. I can never get it to work, and it's always going down, and I can never get the AT&T man to, like, come and fix it. Service and availability is just as patchy. I don't have figures for that. But I think what I do have is an impression, which is that there's no being 18 months ahead in broadband anymore. The people on broadband aren't doing more interesting things in America than they are doing anywhere else. You get broadband, you enter the world of broadband, and then it's fairly stable. You download the same things. You don't spend all your time watching amazing new movies that only you have access to. You just use Yahoo or you just use Google, and it's faster, and it's always on, and you're happy with that. So there isn't that degree of internet... changing your way of life. I think broadband changes your way of life, but doesn't continue changing it for 18 months. Not same as the internet goes. Okay, so we've got this idea of 18 months being a local blip, a feature of internet uptake. Internet caused this lead, and internet growth is now slowing. That's one side of it. There's also something else which is unfortunately much subtler, so I will have to go a bit vague on you at this point, and the facts will dry up. So let's go back to the Roomba, robot little thing going around hoovering. Very good, very good. Haven't had to like Hoover at all recently. Not employed, actually by a company, actually bought thing. Took it back when it broke the first time round. I was that keen on it. I mentioned this in an article in November 2002 in the Sunday Times. Roomba's not launched in the UK. Roomba has no plans to launch in the UK yet, I believe. and wrote about how marvellous it is to live in the land of opportunity where you have robot slaves tidying your house. then suddenly it was. What happened, of course, is people typed Roomba into Google, like you would, found Roomba, found people who sold Roomba, like Sharper Image in America, and started ordering it. And buying it over in the UK, and Roombas started appearing. Now, I have not single-handedly created a robot revolution in Britain, but there's definitely a case that, you know, Roombas are known. These things are known in Britain now. And there isn't this kind of lag that we really took advantage for in the wild days of having these new exciting things that no one has ever heard of that you can then bring over the big C to Europe, and vice versa. You know, I think that one of the things that always fascinated me in Silicon Valley was there were always these things saying, European cars, come here, buy some European cars. And so they're going, European cars are terrible. and this idea of exoticism, simply by virtue of being from somewhere else, you can find out, you can go and look up. Just expanding this a little bit. There's a certain degree of synchronization that takes place. The internet boom started 18 months, actually slightly earlier in the US, I think, although, again, don't have any facts to back me up, it just felt that way. Unfortunately, bad news travels much quickly, and it ended simultaneously in the UK. There were a lot of big IPO launches in Britain were kind of around the Christmas of 2000. People like lastminute.com and so forth, local British companies. Boohoo had a very traditional Silicon Valley IPO because by that time people understood the terminology, people knew what it was like, individual investors knew what the opportunities were, and they started doing the standard time that you'd imagine seeing at, say, Real or somebody like that, and then bam, same time. So they got 3 months of that kind of internet whirlwind. And this happened all over the place. People who had gradually picked up on this idea were suddenly cut short at exactly the same time as they were in America. So you have this weird synchronization of events. Now, isn't this good? Isn't this a good thing, particularly for me? Isn't it good to have one story to tell about these different markets? If the Roomba is suddenly everywhere at one place, isn't that a good thing for people selling stuff, and isn't that a good thing for people researching stuff? You don't have to worry about localization issues. One market, there's one story. Well, not necessarily if you're involved in the internet and PC world, because you do have this idea that eventually people will do what you did in a few months' time. If you start doing this and you sell to the American market, just give it 18 months and eventually everyone will get the same idea. And this isn't true anymore. This is what's happening is you're having the same events and they're being interpreted in different ways. I'm not entirely sure whether I can drop this in, but I did want to mention another gadget. This is something called a photo clip. It's a standard kind of what you'd imagine as leading edge technical product, consumer product. It's cheap. It's not $1,000 or anything like that. It's $150. This one. You can take photographs with it, slightly obviously. You can also take video with it, which isn't very surprising. It also acts as a voice recorder. In fact, it's recording me right now, so I know, you know, that I can use this and play it back and upload it. It's also a file store, so it actually has my backup copies of this presentation, so that if anything went wrong, I could plug it into another PC and download it. And it does all of those things for about $150. The most important thing about this, however, is that it's Bulgarian. It's done by a company. They have a small office in San Jose, but their main research and development staff are in Bulgaria. Now, this is the international SIG. It's not an amazing idea that people develop and come up with these ideas in other countries. What's interesting for me is this is something which seems to be going the other way around the world. Traditionally, Silicon Valley does develop... comes up with consumer applications, which they work with their Korean providers at coming up with the chipsets and the ideas. And then this transfers over the other way. This seems very much a case of Bulgarians talking to Koreans and then selling first to Britain and Europe. If you look on this place, the only places you could find to buy this, apart from their own mail order site, which is where I got it from, are lots of things in Cyrillic, Bulgaria, and other Russian nations who like good, cheap gadgets like this, and British gadget shops. I haven't really seen this picked up in any kind of American places. Again, not really that surprising, but it's a different route. You're getting a different kind of take around on this sort of stuff. It's something that will happen. You know, I don't imagine that the Bulgarians will be the only people producing this kind of tech, but it's something that happened first in Bulgaria, and that's kind of odd. Here's something else that kind of applies to this whole idea. So Stuart Alsop, I have to check he isn't here. Good. Stuart Alsop said something in a recent talk, which I think reflects the dangers. I don't think everybody sits around going, Europe, 18 months older, middle ages they live in over there. But they do sometimes let slip slightly odd things. This is what he said. Will we learn how to text message like European? Maybe. But will the Europeans start using email? Like we do. They use email in Europe, all right? They have problems with some of the fiddly little letters with the accents on top, but email is generally up and working in Europe. There is no lag here. This is a separate development. And text messaging is not just some primitive way of using email until we catch up with the Americans. What you have is simultaneous technological development in these areas. And those technological developments are being used in different ways. And I know that sounds somewhat trite and obvious to say so, but it's something that hasn't been true for the last 2 to 3 years. People use the internet, and you tend to think that people will use it in the same way, and that there will be this progress. But, you know, I'm not sitting here saying that the Americans are 18 months behind the South Koreans, even though South Koreans are much higher up in that penetration. And use the internet in many ways much more interesting ways from the Americans. You know, the massive multiplayer role-playing games and things like that. It's embedded much more clearly into the culture, but I don't think that necessarily means that America will eventually be in the same situation. This is somewhat strange, but I did want to bring this in because it's something that I think brings home the importance of the net in this role. So we have these synchronizing events. We have these things which we put out onto the net, and instantly everybody knows about them. And one of these that happened, unfortunately, very recently, was the Twin Towers. Now, big news stories have happened before. Big news stories have been covered everywhere before. But with something with the emotional impact and the political ramifications of 9/11, what we also saw, I think, certainly what I saw when I was trying to keep on both sides of this debate, both sides of the European and the American debate, was that not only was the news reporting synchronous, and everyone was reading everything that everybody else was saying, but the discussion was synchronous as well. I'm just going to give an example of this. This is, there we go. The reaction to 9/11 was pretty generally the same, but there were small regional variations. And traditionally, again, when I'm talking about journalism, when I'm writing for the Sunday Times and I'm writing for that audience, I'm writing very different things than if I was writing for the Irish Times, say, or if I was writing for an American domestic audience. So this is an article that, wow, pop-up adverts, even when you're offline. That's pretty impressive. or buying what you're selling, whatever. This was an article that's written for a newspaper that I actually used to write for. And it's a fairly... I wouldn't say it was a particularly extreme article. It was somewhat shocking, I think. It was deliberately supposed to be shocking. It was a comment thing. But not unusual in the European press. This was a piece that was called They Can't See Why They're Hated, which is Americans cannot ignore what the government does abroad. This is the sort of thing people write about countries, other countries. What was interesting about this is that, of course, it was also read in America. And if somebody's writing that kind of piece, if that headline that said fog in channel, continent isolated, had actually ever got to the isolated continent, clearly it would have got a different reaction than it got in London. And newspapers aren't really awake to the fact that a large percentage of their audience is actually now foreign, particularly The Guardian, and has other people looking at it. So what we see now is American reactions to European reactions. This is a site which is currently, it's a war blog. I don't know whether you've heard of war blogs, but they're very, very gung-ho, pro the Iraqi war. Often very anti-European, anti-United Nations. This is something taking the Belgians to task for being interested in human rights issues. Now, you know, with the Europeans, we're traditionally not particularly friendly to one another, but we'd never pick on the Belgians. And you know that somewhere there's some very angry Belgian blog very pointing out some flaws in the American system. So what you actually have here is a synchronization, but then a divergence, because you have this single event, but also on the internet you get to see what other people's reactions are. It not only brings us together to see the same world at the same time, but it also lets us expose the differences. And this is why I scribbled out, internet causes synchronization, synchronization leads to divergence, and then I just thought of the Star Wars movies and put divergence leads to suffering. I don't think that's necessarily true, but it's a good Yoda quote. So what are the quotes, what are the conclusions I have about this, if any? I don't think there are any well-worn tracks anymore. It's actually surprising, in retrospect, how complacent we were about the kind of historical inevitability of what the internet and what PCs would do. That a PC on every desk was something that somewhat presumed that we all had desks, but also presumed that the PC was the centerpiece of our homes, and so forth and so forth. Silicon Valley is an American institution, and that can influence how it thinks about things. And that hasn't really mattered up until now, because the American institution has spread. But in the future, as people use technology in different ways, I don't think that's going to occur. And you can't really simplify about markets as well. The problem is, before it was fairly easy to say about countries that they were 18 months ahead, and that gave us a very concrete thing to do. And I think actually it was genuinely positive from the other point of view, from Europe and from Britain. Having an idea of what was going to happen in the future enables us to pick a simplified model of how that future would operate. We could pick out little details about how the American model works, largely from reading issues like Wired. And we could take those hook, line, and sinker. We know what the complications are now. You don't have to be here. I'm not sure if this is true since I've written this presentation. The last two things were saying you don't have to be here and you don't have to be there. And I have a headache. Maybe I'll just go down to that, because that's pretty much what my conclusion here is. Is that if you see the complexities in other nations like this, there's an argument that we don't have to be here. We can continue this technological progress in Bulgaria if need be, because we can pick on the same resources that Silicon Valley can gather together. Is that true? That's always the great question about international investment. Do we really need to be here? Do we have to be there to understand what those markets are like? There's an argument in the facts that we've seen and the wild opinion that I've offered that you don't have to be there anymore, because it doesn't make things any simpler to be there. I don't know. This is going to be a presentation as a journalist where I don't actually have any conclusions, because I'm not selling anything. So I don't have to say yes. In fact, now sign up with my newsletter and I'll tell you which country to invest in. It's a headache. It's made my life a lot more complicated, but I think it's probably going to mean that the next technological boom that we see will be a lot more interesting and a lot more international. So, there you go.
May I interject for a moment? Now you see why I'm a groupie, and I saved these knowing he was coming, so you can see them if you want, and I can download from the Times. So if you want any copies of these things that he's mentioned, if he doesn't email them out, I can.
The articles aren't online, but I will take this as another key for someone. You have to pay for the Sunday Times.
No, I don't. I have a special deal.
Oh.
Because I live there. And so
can
I
you send me copies of my articles?
Make sure you get the burning. FAQ, come on. Questions.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Or Q&A, sorry.
For me personally, the most interesting slide was one about PCs and actually the British being ahead.
It's actually the fact in the whole thing.
My first three computers were British.
Yeah.
DX8, DX81, Think32L. That's where I started my programming career.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was great, and I went into Apple and finally moved here and so on. And in PDA, it was the same way. It was a fire.
Mm-hmm.
But all of them are dead. I mean, is there any future for British?
I think It's like, Amiga will never die, isn't it? Sinclair forever. That's a really interesting question. I think that there were a couple of extinction events. The most important extinction event for the kind of Cambrian explosion of computers that came out of Britain. For those of you who didn't live in Britain, and there were lots of British accents at the beginning of this, back in about 1980, the average British computer cost about $150. They were very cheap and cheerful, they were made out of plastic, they didn't have proper keyboards, but they were affordable for anyone to buy. And this was about the time when American computers have generally cost around about $1,000. So there's this big explosion. I think most of those things were killed stone dead by the IBM PC and standardization. And the rollout, the amazing leverage IBM had in businesses, which nobody realized it at the time, but the next step after home computers were computers that were compatible with what you did at work. So people used IBM PCs at work and they went and bought IBM PCs. It wasn't all negative though, because one of the things that in Britain happened because of that is that Britain has a really odd place quite high up in games programming for consoles. And that's because all of that generation who were brought up programming in these quite restricted environments, in quite often very Byzantine and different programming ideals, went on to the consoles, which had a very similar outfit. I think one of the biggest problems that you have if you're building an integrated unit is that it's very hard to give that kind of brand oomph if you don't have market placement in America. I think it just gives your brand an extra force. So I think it's very hard. For instance, you know, I don't think this, as I said, I don't think this will be the last ever combined instrument like this. There will be a Sony version of this. I think that Casio is almost there. Casio has a very similar thing, but without a flash. And, you know, these won't last forever. The Bulgarian camera market will collapse. But in fact, it won't, because the technical people who are designing this will just become OEMs. I think that's probably what would have normally have happened. And Cyan, you know, Cyan's a very good example. Cyan is essentially now producing the operating system which drives most mobile technologies, or, you know, the ones that haven't sold their soul. And Symbian is the position that you find these things. Like anything, these things turn and iterate, and eventually you find them in some completely different form. And, you know, the reason why they can take that slot is because it's very easy to transfer PDA knowledge into mobile phones from their point of view. So there will always be niches. You just don't get the brand names.
I think it's really exciting about the you don't have to be there idea, and that the world is converging and we can know what people are thinking and feeling everywhere. And one would think from that we wouldn't then be able to get away with ethnocentrism.
This is the big contradiction that lies at the heart of this, I think, is that actually what I'm worried, I am yet to come to any conclusion about, is whether this actually accentuates ethnocentricity, because it means that the best way of dealing with ethnocentricity is to have everybody having the same goal of being non-ethnocentric. And if you can look around and you can see what other countries are doing, and you kind of, again, it's a question of niches. If you're kind of looking at other countries, there is this kind of shimmy, and the EU does this at the moment. Everybody in the EU is looking for their place. And their place is not to be, you know, the other Germany. Each of these places are like shimmying to find niches for their industry and for their culture. And what that actually means is you get greater differentiation, which is actually what you want to have in a global market. But what I think that means is that often that means that you end up reacting to what other countries do and defining yourself against other countries, which is not what we have as the ideal of, you know, one great world living together.
I was wondering, talking about technology, but the other side is the American business model of selling stuff. And if you look at the American telecommunications system, you can stay logged on to the internet for 24 hours a day, which is free over here. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Britain and the continent, you can't do that. So perhaps internet usage is not the availability of the technology, but the cost of using it. And that's the Europe behind in that sense, because a lot of those telecommunications companies are being price heavy.
what's interesting about the internet, and I think one of the things that keeps coming back to this is that the internet is the thing that has made both that 18 months idea work for so long and also harbaged its end, is that the internet actually did change pricing models. Certainly in the UK, I don't know how far this spreads into Europe, in that you can now get flat rate phone calls in Britain. It doesn't actually fit very well into the British pricing structure, but you can get it because people wanted it for net use. And that, oddly, I mean, the other great comparison for this, of course, is mobile phones, where a lot of people in Europe believe that the reason why mobile phones didn't really take off in the States is because you pay for every call that comes in. People in Europe are accustomed to paying to call people, and I'm sure lots of people know this whole pattern. But basically, the thing is that the idea of having to pay for somebody to call your mobile seems ridiculous to a lot of Europeans, and that's a spin-off of having to pay for every phone call. I guess what's interesting here is because the internet has been something that has been so easily translatable to other places, and benefits from such good network effects, and that the bigger it is, the more attractive it is, you get it actually forcing different pricing structures on the rest of the world, which you don't get the other way around. There is no huge networking effect to having a huge mobile phone population in other countries, but none in America, or very little in America. So there's very little incentive in America to copy and adopt those pricing structures. Even when now I believe that the FCC has allowed them to do so. So I think you're right, but I think the internet was one of those things that just could knock over those kind of barriers.
Yeah,
just,
a little higher than anybody else can take advantage of it. Would you do some sort of wild forecasting? What's that next?
18 months ahead. Or three. I can do three.
Well, something. We're waiting. At least I'm waiting. What is the next? What is it? I've been in Silicon Valley off and on a long time, and I've seen the wave. What do you think the next wave is? Is it nanotechnology?
I can only gauge this on enthusiasm because I have no business sense at all. But I know what people are enthusiastic about. People are enthusiastic about Wi-Fi. People are very enthusiastic about GPS technology as well. There's a lot of... I think this year there's going to be a lot... And this year is not the year that they will make money because, you know, it's the year of the network again. But I think this year the thing that people seem to be really into is geolocation. The idea that everything has a latitude and longitude, that everything has a position, and you can get things to report that position, and you can have a database of those things. The most kind of naff description of this is the idea that has fortunately failed in Europe, is this idea as you carry around a mobile phone, and as you walk past Starbucks, you get like $5 off coupons. And very real. There's a crisis of the commons there, and they're just walking around. People are perpetually phoning you up, offering you deals on buildings you're just driving past down the freeway. Every strip mall has an offer. So, but that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is just using the location of places and GPS technologies. Prices are going down, and you know, you have people like Steve Wozniak working on this stuff. And on the software side, people are very interested in that kind of thing as well. And I guess the other thing is, I think people are very enthusiastic about is very small, thirsty communications between things. I mean, the place that I'm trying to expand this slightly, but the place I see this the most is on the weblogs and syndication and things like this on the web. People are getting to the point now where they actually want their websites to talk to each other. There's a great flurry of development on this. Somebody said that actually somebody was writing going, you know, more robots, more automated systems read my web page now than readers do. Because you have all of these things going out, picking up data and putting it together. And I think there are two sides to that. One is that one of the reasons why that is because a lot of people realize that you can do this from your home machine or you can do this from your site. And the other, so there's a lot of them around. And there's a sort of side to that that means that that's going to be very prevalent. But there's also a lot of information to be gleaned from that. There's a lot of information you can find about what people think about what you're doing and what else is going on like that. I think our idea of web services and metadata has always been this idea of like there would be a big company like Microsoft, like .NET, or IBM, and you would go there and say, tell me where the best place to buy screws is, and they would tell you, or they would tell your computer, and then it would buy the best screws for you. And this is not how this seems to be working in a much more distributed way, and it seems odd, it's a very inefficient idea that all of these things are scurrying out looking, but people have the technology now, so there might be something coming up there. No money in it, but it's what people are very interested in. There, you're right. My wife keeps putting up her hand, and I don't know, I'm torn now. I'll answer that question later, but
contraction.
Oh, contraction, okay. I'll answer you, that will be the sign that we'll finish. I'll ask my wife, so.
I was just, wireless issue that you, Wi-Fi is hot, right? And I'm just really puzzled by where that's going. I just came from an entrepreneurs conference on Wi-Fi, and they're all talking about RPUs, return per unit of cell phones.
Right.
And they can't figure out how to make it pay.
How to make Wi-Fi pay or cell phones? 3G pay.
Cell phones.
Yeah, 3G is...
So just selling cell phones, doing wireless, they can't get the subscriptions to pay if people will subscribe, for like here. But they really don't see how it's going to pay.
Can I come back to that? Because I think it might feed into somebody else's question. So, did you have a question? Watch me.
I'm not a plant. I just said I hadn't seen the presentation. But the thing I really, really was reminded of when you were talking about the 18 months was sitting with a group of veteran, very accomplished marketers in 95 explaining again and again in slow words how their demographic data was not going to help them in the net.
Right.
And now watching kind of the collapse that you described, it seems like I would end up being back in that room going, well, you might want to dust that off.
Right.
Yes,
I can. Which you did. the one thing I didn't have time to put into this, do I have time now? Yeah, what the hell, is that there's a very good report that I actually pulled a lot of the comparisons of, which was actually about the digital divide. It was actually about the American market, but they were also comparing it with the British market just to compare, just have something to compare it with. And the very good point that they made out was that, and see if I can get the figures right, is that Britain at that point was 18 months behind the UK, behind the US, but there were parts of the US that were 14 years behind the other parts of the US. And you can divide this into demographics. That's just an average. And the if you look at demographics, the saturation point is the saturation point. The people who buy PCs are the same people who buy these gadgets, people who know that they need a PC or know that they need to replace their old PC. And it peaked at 60%, but mobile phones peak at, currently it's 76% in Britain and rising. I think that's the 2001 figures. And they're in near ubiquity in other places. So, yeah, I don't know whether that's what the point you're making, but demographics are kind of important in the next stage of these things.
By the time it translated internationally, it was kind of soft enough by the time it hit that they could make their own thing out of it.
Yeah.
And that's just not sounding like it was working.
It seems hard to say that the internet boom was actually relatively predictable. we knew what was going to happen now. But in retrospect, a lot of it was. It was hard to predict the leading edge, but the trailing edge was very simple. And it's just not the case anymore. It's going to be really hard to work out how to sell computers and this stuff to the next people that you need to sell this stuff to. I didn't get back to Wi-Fi, sorry. I can talk all day about it.
Well, we can talk about other things now, too. Danny, thank you so much, and I'm so glad I persevered. Don't you think so? Thank you. If I really work hard, do you think I can get him to come back? Maybe just to hang out with us a bit.
18 months.
No, no, it's no longer 18 months. Wake up. I learned that from Danny O'Brien. So I'll clutch my fan mail over here, my fan things here. However, I have a surprise. Christine Malmberg has just made it. Will you give us a quick presentation about Northern Ireland and a couple of the programs coming up? One of our sponsors.
I'm Christine Malmberg, Business Development Manager for Invest Northern Ireland, and a sponsor of the FD Fund for International Space. Invest Northern Ireland is an economic development agency and UK government, and our role here in the United States is to increase awareness about the business development opportunities in Northern Ireland and to raise awareness of the fact that Northern Ireland is a global player and a knowledge-based economy. We do this by providing a broad range of services and supports, all free of charge, and it includes a tailored financial assistance package to help get businesses started up right away. Another thing that we're trying to do, something along the lines of what Danny was mentioning, strategies for countries to achieve sustainable competitive advantage while competing in the global marketplace, is to become niche players in certain industries and certain markets. And Northern Ireland's initiative is to be a niche player in the wireless market. So some of the questions that I believe you have, where is it going, what's all this about, as an average reference for the user, what are the carriers trying to do to ensure that they continue to grow that while voice services are going flat, all that can be answered at our next event. It's a special event co-organized by Invest UK and Invest Northern Ireland, sponsored by the FD Forum, and it's going to be on March 25th from noon to 4. We have a lineup of speakers featuring Gartner, OpenWave, British Telecom, ourselves to talk about Northern Ireland, and a few others, hopefully, to represent academia and venture capital. So it's also a luncheon, and it's open to people that are wanting to know what's going on in Europe in the wireless arena. What I'm going to do is pass out, this is just a brief flyer with few details that Danny will be confirmed. So I'll pass this out for your information, and if you'd like to know more, feel free to drop me a line.
That's it, and you can always contact me too. Well, let's see, where are we? Where are we is that I think about half of you are visitors. I hope you'll be coming back. Our meetings are the third Monday of the month. As you can see, we're pretty casual, pretty informal. Whoops. And we do seem to have some very interesting speakers, Danny being a prime example. And I hope that you'll join us again. If you haven't signed up, I think that Gloria, in black with a red shawl or coat, I think you have a list, don't you? Do you have the sign-up sheet? Oh, it's on the table. If you haven't signed up, please sign up on your way out. We do have some more drink. We do have a lot more to talk about. Charlie has the keys, and we can stay later than 9 o'clock if we want. So thank you very much for coming. Charlie and I are pleased to have you. And Laura, thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much.
Wine is still food lab, too.
I just want to catch something for me.
I'm going to go to the next one.